Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and we're listening to the divisions in Scotland and England over a referendum for the Scots to go it alone and become independent. Also, at the end of this hour, the end of life and how extending life for some patients can degrade the quality of their deaths. It's a big issue in healthcare right now. But we begin with the divisions in the National Football League among fans and players over the scandals that have turned the past few weeks and months into what some commentators are calling the most explosive and negative period for the NFL in its history. As we've already observed on this program, the NFL is not football, and football is more than just the NFL. But that may be the problem here. An estimated 1 million boys across the country play high school football. And the 2014 Super Bowl snatched the largest television audience in U.S. history. 111.5 million Americans tuned in. So player misconduct is magnified as having the potential to influence young men, and due to NFL ratings, has the highest of profiles in the public square. So NFL fan or not, you've heard these names this week: Ray Rice, Adrian Peterson, Jonathan Dwyer, Greg Hardy, all embroiled in domestic violence or assault disputes. These cases and the NFL's handling of them is what's being talked about in the first weeks of the season. The NFL has a special status in society and as a business. Does that mean it has a greater responsibility to handle scandals of this kind? Joining us is Harvey Schiller, commissioner for America's Cup 35 and former president of the International Baseball Federation. Also with us is Nicholas Davidoff, author of Collision, Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football. And Jane McManus is a sports writer who covers the New York Giants and Jets for ESPN New York. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's take this apart in three pieces, if we could. You know, there's a management question for the NFL. Harvey, can you remind us what it is about the NFL that makes it special as a corporation? It has a status almost unlike any other, with the possible exception of baseball, right?
Yes. Well, it's effectively it has some federal exclusions. And because of that, it can operate both as a not-for-profit, but looks like a profit in some of the other ways. Yes.
And Jane, do the players have an understanding? Do the players have a sense that the NFL is special, is a different kind of workplace?
I don't know that they necessarily, you know, sense that some of those organizing factors make a big difference on their lives. I mean, I do think that they know that Roger Goodell, who's the commissioner of the NFL, has said it's a privilege to play in the league, so that they have a personal conduct policy, and that personal conduct policy is administered through the league office and through Roger Goodell. And it means that any off-the-field issues can be subject to fines and suspensions if the league decides that should happen.
Nicholas, it seems that we've seen this as a very whimsical policy, in that on the one hand, maybe they're just deferring to law enforcement. On the other hand, they're weighing in, you know, heavily on other kinds of issues. Has it always been a sort of gray area where the NFL deals with the off the field issues?
You know, one of the things about the NFL that's true both on the field and off the field is that it's notorious for constantly renegotiating and changing legislation. This is both rules of conduct and rules of play. What's happening right now makes the entire country wince and cringe. These are lurid stories, and it's horrible. But one of the things that's also true is that the NFL players are not a monolith, that the NFL is a large group of people. Many, many people come through every football team every year. And, you know, Rex Ryan, who's the coach of the Jets, generally begins his first conversation with his players at the beginning of training camp by talking about just how diverse the composition of a team is. He'll say things like, you know, we've got religious guys and faithless guys and fat guys and skinny guys and married guys and single guys and, you know, on like that. And it's definitely true that the NFL has a lot of good guys and a few bad guys.
So, Jane McManus, given that diversity that Nicholas is talking about there, how does the NFL typically treat these domestic violence cases?
538 recently did a story where they looked at the way that the NFL has treated domestic violence and how many game suspensions were issued by the NFL. And historically, the penalties handed out have been lower, you know, one game suspensions, things like that, as opposed to to other infractions. You know, it's funny, you mentioned Rex Ryan. One of the players on his team, Quincy Enunwa, is actually facing a domestic violence charge right now. He's a practice squad player, but he hasn't been deactivated. He's still practicing with the team. He's still in the locker room every day. You know, so I think, you know, the NFL has taken on these things itself. When Roger Goodell was hired, that was one of the things he wanted to do, you know, was kind of raise the standards. And, you know, if that's what your employer does, you are kind of beholden to what they say their particular standards are.
And Harvey, the NFL embraces this issue that we are America. You see it with the flags out on the field. You see it because that's what the sponsors are buying. They're not just buying a normal entertainment, a sitcom or a drama. They're buying this America idea here. And if the NFL can't sell that, we got a problem.
Well, I think basically they're buying eyeballs. The NFL is unlike the other major leagues in that there are no guaranteed contracts. And that's why through time, you've seen in particular cases where an owner may release a player for a variety of reasons. Normally, it's because of how they play or not play. But when things come through the punishment side for these disciplinary issues, it really raises its level to the commissioner. And I think most of that is because the owners at their particular level really defer to the commissioner because how it may or may not affect the entire league.
And Nicholas, is this role model idea for the NFL a business model? Is it just a matter of eyeballs? Do we put the NFL in this special sort of sociological category at our peril?
It's actually a pretty complicated question. I think without question, the NFL is first and foremost a business. And I think you can see right now that many people are concerned that the NFL is operating with a certain corporate callousness or in sometimes corporate discomfort at the moment too. The one of the things that I think about this, though, is that, you know, the way that an institution behaves, a large institution behaves, definitely influences and affects the way that people who work for it behave. And I think that people within the NFL are definitely always paying attention to what the NFL does in these moments. I think just as though as a public, the way that our big institutions behave define us sort of as people, and they help us and they become a prism through which we, you know, we see ourselves. And so that I think that the only really good that's coming out of this is that it becomes a public conversation, that because there is an NFL and because people like it so much and because people are behaving in this way, that we talk about the various things that the NFL is, you know, staggering its way through, like domestic violence or animal rights or child abuse or bullying or concussions or gay rights. Or these are all big conversations because people like the NFL so much.
Jane McManus, Nicholas was suggesting that Rex Ryan talks a lot about diversity, you know, when he speaks to his Jets players. You cover the Jets as well. Looking at the sort of executive suites at the NFL, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of diversity up there, and maybe that's a problem.
That's absolutely right. And one of the things that the NFL has done in the wake of this has been to hire women. They hired four women, one who's going to be a VP of the social responsibility, and three others who will be able to advise on issues of domestic violence and personal conduct policy. But, you know, this, it's an entertainment product. The NFL is an entertainment product. And the Ray Rice video, I think, opened a lot of people's eyes that, you know, when you go to a game on Sunday and you want to scream your heart out for your team, you don't want to feel conflicted about who you're screaming for and what they stand for. And unfortunately, the NFL is in a situation now where if they let players like Greg Hardy, who's the Carolina Panther, who has actually been convicted in a bench trial of domestic violence, if they let players like that on the field, I think that now makes fans conflicted.
But is it enough, the women in management, 29% women in management positions? Seems like an incremental change that you've described here. Does there need to be more of a sea change, given just how devastating this has been in public relations terms?
Well, I don't think it's the number of women in management. I think it's the power that those women have. You know, looking at the way that Roger Goodell adjudicated a domestic violence case this summer, you would be hard-pressed to think anyone with any experience in domestic violence had been involved in the decision-making process.
That's Jane McManus, who covers the New York Jets for ESPN New York. Harvey Schiller, you know, let's end on the notion of the fans here. What are fans to do? Fans want something to make this go away, and that sort of argues for Goodell's got to go. What do you think the NFL should do here to get fans back to their sense of the game?
Well, I think they have to keep reinforcing the message, what they will or will not tolerate. I think one of the things we haven't mentioned is that you know, there's been a transition from what was really a sport to really what is entertainment. And these, every player on the field, because of their over-identification through not just social media, but typical media and normal media, is just like any other entertainer. So the question of their individual behavior is, again, because they're in the spotlight every day. And I think the NFL is waking up to that, just like every other league has had to wake up to it before. I think the future for the fan, as you ask, is really, let's get back to the game. I think that's what they're mainly concerned about.
Final thought on that, Nicholas?
Well, I think something that Jane just said, she used the word the NFL protects itself. And I think that this is really the big public concern right now, that you have young people who are going out and playing a very dangerous sport and they're getting hurt. You have young people who are going out and doing horrible things to other people without real response to the NFL until after these things become big public sources of conversation. And if you ask me, what the NFL should do is that it should become more transparent. It should become more proactive rather than reactive. It should seem like more of a humane organization. It would be much better for fans if we could admire the NFL, if they would, you know, if they would take the lead on so many of these problems rather than being responsive and sometimes being defensive. That, you know, in terms of concussions, why aren't they investigating impact studies before anybody else? Most NFL players are African American men. Why isn't the NFL part of the Ferguson conversation? You know, the NFL has so much power in a public conversation, and they seem always, I think what makes people ultimately so queasy is that they use that power only to protect themselves. That's hard for people.
And that's a really big idea there, Nicholas. Interesting. Jane McManus, I'll give you the final word here. Will Goodell's legacy be the guy who fixed this and got the NFL back into a leadership role on some of these big questions that Nicholas is talking about? Or will he be the guy who made a lot of money for the NFL and got bounced in a scandal?
You know, I'm beginning to think it's going to be the latter, if only because he has such a credibility issue. I've been listening, you know, over the last week or so as players have been publicly laughing about, you know, the situation that Goodell is in right now. Here is the Law and Order commissioner who now is facing an investigation of his own and under quite a bit of suspicion about whether or not the Ray Rice interior elevator tape made it to his office and he somehow didn't see it. You know, he's a guy who said in Bounty Gate that ignorance is not an excuse. And here he is saying that he was unaware of this interior elevator tape or that he, quote, suspected that it was there. Everybody knew that there was an interior elevator tape. So I think the next time that Roger Goodell wants to hand out a fine or hand out a suspension, I think that he is going to face a credibility gap there. And that's the real problem. I also think it's worth pointing out that the vast majority of NFL players will never hit another person or a child. And this is bad for them because they are now being painted with one brush, and that's not fair to any of them.
Jane McManus is a sports writer who covers the New York Giants and Jets for ESPN New York. She joined us from Ossining, New York. Harvey Schiller is a commissioner for America's Cup 35, former president of the International Baseball Federation, a former executive director and secretary general of the United States Olympic Committee. And Nicholas Davidoff is author of Collision, Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football. We want to put this to you. What does the NFL need to do to address this problem? Get rid of Goodell? What else? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
In Scotland's story, I read that they came, the Gael and the Pict, the Angle and Dane, but so did the Irishman, Jew and Ukraine. They're all Scotland's story and they're all worth the same.
After all the waiting, decision day has finally arrived in Scotland. Nearly all of the more than 4 million people eligible to vote in today's independence referendum may go to the polls, which are open all day and into the night. One of those voters joining us now is Jenny Green on the streets of Edinburgh, who couldn't be more excited about this history-making day in what soon could be her new independent country.
It's incredible, actually. It's I've never felt anything like it. Everyone's talking about the vote and whether you've voted and how you're voting and why.
And you've made up your mind, right?
Yes.
All right, don't tell me what you've decided, but you have made up your mind. Now, Mabel Sharp, you're in Marblehead, Massachusetts. You've also made up your mind, and you've actually voted, right, Mabel?
I have indeed. I had a postal vote before I came out.
And Mabel, you are a relative of Jenny, right?
I am Jenny's grandmother.
All right. So do you suspect, Mabel, that you are on the same page with Jenny as far as this referendum is going? And don't tell me your vote yet, all right?
Okay, I'm afraid I'm not.
So you disagree. Mabel and Jenny, you're on different sides of this issue.
I guess we may be.
I would never argue with my grandmother.
Oh, really? Here's your chance. Here's your chance, Jenny. Let's find out. Where are you on this vote? Where are you?
I'm going to vote yes.
Going to vote yes. And Mabel, you're not going to vote yes. You're going to vote no. You've already voted no.
I have voted no.
All right. Give me your case to Jenny, Mabel.
I feel that as a country, we are not yet prepared or we are not equipped to be on our own. And I have had so many benefits from being in the Union, so I voted no.
Jenny, what's wrong with that argument?
I feel like it's now or never, in a way. If we don't take this chance now, there's a possibility we'll certainly not have it again in this generation.
Mabel, it's about democracy and the future and the younger generation. That's what Jenny's telling you.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. And I think it's wonderful that she has this spirit behind her and this faith in our country. At the moment, I don't have the faith in the people who would be running this country. I want to see someone with more depth, someone I can really trust, prepared to run the country before I hand it over to them.
Well, I think it's important to remember that actually in this referendum, we're not voting for the people who are going to run it. We're just voting for the chance to run it ourselves. And so anyone could get into politics now.
All right, we're talking with Jenny Green, who is the granddaughter of Mabel Sharp, who's already both are voting in the referendum. Actually, Mabel has already voted because she's in Marblehead, Massachusetts, with her son, Rod Sharp, who joins us now. Rod, you have an American passport, I understand, right?
Almost, John.
But that means you're out of this. You can't
vote.
Yes. Yeah, you're.
Yeah, yeah. I'm out of it anyway. I mean, I don't reside in Scotland. I'm not a resident of Scotland, you know. And I'd love to vote today, but that's not the way it's working. I'd be more annoyed if I still lived in London and I couldn't vote, as 750,000 other Scots do. I think they're very unhappy people right now.
Are you unhappy witnessing the extraordinary divisions in your own family as a result of this referendum that we've been witnessing?
Well, I'd say the divisions in my family are going to heal a good deal quicker than some of the divisions in the rest of the country. You know, and this is awfully strange. You know, I speak as a man who walked down Princes Street in 1979 with his father on the day of a referendum on giving Scotland more devolution. And that referendum was defeated by political shenanigans. And I was terribly upset about that. And yet today, I see this vote as primarily divisive. And I'm sad about that, John.
All right, Rod, hold on to that thought. We're going to take a short break. This is The Takeaway. So it's a little bit like 1776 over there in Scotland today, voting whether to reject British rule from Westminster or go it alone. It's divided families in Scotland, just as Americans were divided between the Royalists and the Patriots so long ago. As we've just heard, we're talking to one of these divided families going to the polls today. Jenny Green is a proud Scot in the Yes camp. She's in Edinburgh. Her grandmother, Mabel Sharp, is visiting the U.S., but already voted no before she left to visit her son, Rod Sharp, in Massachusetts. Rod hosts his BBC show Up All Night from Marblehead, Mass. Now, Rod, you're living outside of Scotland and therefore can't vote, but you've been talking about nothing besides independence for months now on your show. What are the expats saying?
I had a pretty interesting discussion last night with a fellow from Washington who is among those Scots who have gone to Scotland to campaign for Yes. I mean, there have been very prominent Scots involved. Of course, people like Sean Connery and Alan Cumming have gone to Scotland to campaign for Yes, and with great success, it has to be said. But we also I talked to a woman who, in the summertime, was so dismayed at the weakness of the so-called Better Together campaign that she founded her own online social campaign, something called Let's Stay Together, which resulted in thousands of people jamming themselves into Trafalgar Square on Sunday, most of them people without a vote in Scotland, to say, don't go. I mean, there's been a tremendous upwelling of that kind of sentiment, and people are only really just beginning to see the consequences of this vote by 7% of the UK population, which can permanently alter the nature of the United Kingdom.
And in terms of people in London, are they afraid of what's going to happen here? There's certainly a lot of emotion in Scotland around the world. Fear of what's going to happen?
Yeah, I think it's a day of fear. I mean, there's a very interesting color piece on the front of the Financial Times this morning, in which the writer invokes fear and terror. He says it's a day of real fear and terror. So I'm thrilled to hear Jenny say it's not, and that it's, people are so up about it. Among people with pointy heads, there's a good deal of anxiety and more about this vote, John.
All right, so there's no point on your head, Jenny Green, but there is a suspicion here among your elders that the likes of Sean Connery have maybe pulled the wool over your eyes and given you a kind of naive view of all this.
I would say it's not naive, and I would actually disagree that there's a lot of anxiety and fear also among people voting yes and people voting no in Edinburgh today, for sure. But I would say that in terms of the wool being pulled over our eyes, I really believe in democracy. But for this, for us to prove that it's actually a democracy and what the people want, then we can't listen to the financial sector and the big businesses telling us that we shouldn't vote yes, because that, for me, completely defeats the point of living in a democracy, where it should be what the people want and what the people need. And right now in Scotland, then one in four children live in poverty, and that shouldn't happen in such a wealthy first world country. And it's not been changing underneath the present powers. So I don't think it's about having the wool pulled over our eyes. I think it's about the people standing up and saying, let's do something about this. And yes, the status quo aren't going to like it, and maybe it's going to cause a lot of chaos, but maybe it's just a chance that we need to take because things aren't good enough right now.
The independent Scottish voice of Jenny Green, Mabel Sharp, you know, you've got to admire what she sings. Sounds like she might get into politics.
I'm proud of my granddaughter. I think that's wonderful. And I'm so thrilled to hear her thinking so deeply and expressing her feelings about it. And God bless her and good luck to her in the future. But at present, we're not ready for it.
Jenny?
When are we going to be ready for it? You know, I think one of the sad things about the general Scottish culture is we do have a feeling that we're not good enough, and that we're almost kind of little brother or little sister to the rest of the UK. And actually, sometimes when you, well, to continue the analogy, sometimes when you grow up, you need to leave home and stop blaming your parents for all the problems in your lives. And maybe what will happen if we get an independent Scotland is that we won't be able to blame Westminster anymore, and we'll have to stand up and take responsibility. And that might be hard, like leaving home is, but maybe it'll also be a good thing because we'll be able to grow into something really special.
Grandma, being under the thumb of Westminster has stunted your emotional growth. You've not grown up yet.
Jenny, you're quite right, darling. If I were younger, I would probably be voting like you. I'm sure I would. But you see, I'm just being the cagey old so-and-so and preserving my status quo, which I'm very comfortable with. You know, I've got pension rights and all these kind of things, and at the moment they are determined by the union.
All right, Jenny, it sounds like you may have convinced her on emotional terms, even if she's not going to vote her pocketbook here or change her vote because of her pension. What about that, getting into politics, Jenny? Is that the next step?
Well, maybe at the risk of sounding cliched, the great thing right now is that everyone is in politics in Scotland for once. And that's how it should be, that the people are really getting involved in politics for once, rather than leaving it up to the men in suits down south. So for today, I feel like I'm in politics.
All right. So Mr. Detached, worried expat, Rod Sharp, host of Up All Night on BBC Radio 5, call this. What's it going to be? What's going to happen?
You know, I feel like a man in suit down south as well, Jenny, when I hear you say that. That's terrible. Anyway, I can only look at the latest Ipsos Mori polling for the Evening Standard, which is still calling it for no, but with a statistical margin of error, 53-47, 53 yes, 47 no, John. But how about the undecideds who are there in the middle? They could be 5%, they could be as many as 14%, according to some of the polling. So that's where we're going to find out what happens. We really won't know until very, very late tonight, early, in fact, Friday morning, our time here in the East Coast, before we will know the result of this referendum.
Rod Sharp, host of Up All Night on BBC Radio 5. And for the yes voters, Jenny Green, Rod's niece, and speaking to us from Edinburgh, Scotland. Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you.
And Mabel Sharp, Jenny's grandmother and Rod's mother, a no voter in the referendum. Mabel, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Rod, get to work healing the divisions in your own family there.
I'll try.
Thanks so much. So at the end of our hour, some thoughts about the end of life in the reform-minded environment of healthcare right now. Doctors are learning that there is a huge difference between keeping someone alive in the last months and weeks of life and getting a person and their family comfortable and prepared for an inevitable death. Paula Faber's death last year at age 72 after 11 months of treatments is a painful memory made needlessly painful, says husband Ron, by the doctors heroically trying to save her. Looking back now, Ron wishes his final memories of his wife were different.
I would have rather had a really okay 4.5 months with her than this endless set of treatments.
The Faber story was told by our partners at WNYC. And life extension treatments, all about survival at all costs and palliative care to prepare people and families for death and not postponing that death, may be incompatible. That's what a new report called Dying in America declares. A nonpartisan committee at the National Academy of Sciences says this nation's end-of-life care system is broken and needs a major overhaul to redefine standards of care and the way end-of-life care is financed and delivered. Dr. Diane E. Meyer is director of the Center to Advance Palliative Care at the Icahn School of Medicine. She was on the committee appointed by the Institute of Medicine to put together this new report. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you very much.
So what scenarios are we talking about here? And in your clinical experience and those of your colleagues, what scenarios are we really looking to target in this report to begin with?
Well, I think a very important point for everybody to understand is this is not about an either-or care model. Either we make you comfortable or we put you in the intensive care unit on a ventilator. It's not this sort of black and white choice. Mm-hmm. That, in fact, most people with serious illness in the United States and in many parts of the world have chronic diseases like stroke, like heart failure, like emphysema, like kidney failure, like even cancer is now predominantly a chronic disease with which people live for many years, sometimes more than a decade.
That's a really interesting point.
So the point is really not what do we do when we know you're about to die, although that's an important issue. The point is what do we do to make all these extra years worth having? So it's not a choice between life prolonging or disease treatment and treatment focused on quality of life. It's the integration of those two approaches that this report calls for.
You know, I'm struck that so many families don't necessarily have an awareness of where things become chronic versus cured. Do doctors have a way of saying, okay, folks, we're into the chronic zone now. We're going to be living for a long time with this, and we need to prepare for the fact that you're going to probably die of this condition. Do doctors go from cure to chronic easily?
I think our training as physicians, unfortunately, does not prepare us to think about the long haul with our patients and families and to help prepare patients and families for what to expect over what may be a very, very long time that has enormous consequences for their future, for the family, for whether the caregiver can continue to work, whether the child's college funds will have to be spent on caring for the chronically ill loved one at home. I mean, there are enormous personal and family implications of living for years, decades with serious chronic illness. And I know from my own experience and from teaching in a medical school that we are not preparing young physicians, either undergraduate medical school or residency, to help our patients and families plan for that and be prepared to deal with it. And in large part, the fault lies both with medical and nursing education, which is still stuck in a pattern of training that might have been appropriate 100 years ago or 50 years ago, but really has not evolved to keep up with the fact that most people have chronic debilitating illness for a long time. And secondly, the way we pay for healthcare in this country is we pay you more if you do more things to people. We pay for 911 calls, ER visits, hospitalizations. We don't pay for the help you need at home. So surprise, surprise, when people are desperate and exhausted and don't know where to turn, they call 911 because they can't get help at home. And what we've got is a system that only pays for hospitalization, essentially, and diagnostic tests and treatments, whereas the needs of most people with chronic long-term illness are for more help at home.
So paying for curative treatments, that's a no-brainer in our system. But making people comfortable in their sort of chronic years, whether they're at home or in the hospital, that's a tougher sell to insurance companies and Medicare, for instance.
It's a tougher sell largely because in our legislation in the United States, in statute, in Medicare statute, it is written that Medicare will pay for all, quote, medically necessary, unquote, services. That does not include, for example, paying for a companion to help you bathe or dress or get down the stairs in your home. I'll tell you a story. I went to visit Dame Cicely Saunders in London when she had metastatic cancer. She was the founder of the modern palliative care field. And I went to say thank you and say goodbye. And it was fascinating. Here she was in her 80s, living alone in one of those three-story narrow row houses in London with one rose bush in the front yard, and lived alone, no help, tremendous pain that she was managing with opioids at home. And how did she do it? They had a tuck-in service in England. So every morning at 8 a.m., someone with a high school education would come and help her get up, bathed, dressed, take her meds, get down the steps, give her breakfast, put lunch in the fridge, lay out her meds for the day, and settle her in the sitting room.
And that kind of service has nothing to do with the single-payer system in Britain. We could do that tomorrow in the United States with legislation and a responsible progressive insurance.
Precisely. I mean, so why was she able to remain at home and independent, as was her wish? She did not want to go into an institution because in England they could pay for the tuck-in service. This did not require doctors, nurses, social workers, medication, but we can't pay for that under Medicare.
Let's think about one other thing. Families are taught that if you shift over to the comfort issues of chronic care, you've given up. And that's wrong, right?
Well, precisely. Not only is that wrong, that people living with a serious illness deserve and should demand attention to their quality of life, their management of pain, management of depression or anxiety, support for exhausted, overwhelmed family caregivers, safe housing, adequate nutrition, transportation. These are all things that are critical to a serious illness. But very importantly, and very important for the public to understand, there are now about 6 studies that show that people that get palliative care, that is care focused on their quality of life, at the same time as disease treatment, whether chemotherapy or treatment for heart failure, live longer, significantly longer, than people who only get the disease-focused treatment.
Which really transforms and causes us to think about that issue of medically necessary. Dr. Diane Meyer, let's hope that this report really makes it into the sort of front of doctors' to-do lists and legislators and policymakers, because this is a really important issue for all of healthcare. Dr. Diane Meyer, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Meyer is director of the Center to Advance Palliative Care at the Icahn School of Medicine. So before we go, some of you want to get into that NFL roundtable we had at the beginning of this hour.
My name's Colin. I'm in Akron, Ohio. The NFL is selling an entertainment product, but they're also selling the players as role models. That's the reason that they have a problem. And if they would take the lead on social issues, if they would make sure that they've got so-called character guys on the field, it does make it easier for the fan to root for them. It does give them a better product. It does sell America to the fans.
We're a fan of you joining our roundtable. Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send a tweet to @TheTakeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.